Salut, ici Matt Track, vous écoutez CKUT 90,3 FM.
Against COVID-19 is now underway for priority groups. Visit quebec.ca/COVID-vaccine to follow the vaccination sequence planned for your area and book your appointment online. If necessary, you can also call 1-877-644-4545. Once you've been vaccinated, it's important to continue to protect yourself by following the basic health guidelines. The vaccine, a safe way to protect ourselves. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
The alert level in your region or a neighboring region is red. To curb the spread of COVID-19, gatherings with family and friends in private homes and yards are prohibited. Travel between regions should be avoided, and traveling to yellow zones is forbidden. It's forbidden to leave your home between 8 p.m. and 5 a.m. Visit quebec.ca/coronavirus to learn more about the other measures in place. Follow all the rules, all the time, no exceptions. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned.
Good evening everyone, my name is Michael Buchert and I am the Vice President of Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East, or CJPME. I'm pleased to welcome you to tonight's webinar, Where is Palestine at the Canadian Museum for Human Rights? Before we start, I want to acknowledge that this event is taking place on Indigenous land across Turtle Island. We are hosting this event from the city of Montreal, which is on the unceded territory of the Kanien'kehá:ka Nation, which has historically been known as a gathering place for many First Nations. Some of our guests are coming from the city of Winnipeg, which is located on Treaty 1 territory, on the traditional lands of the Anishinaabe, Cree, Oji-Cree, and Dene peoples, and on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We are also hosting this event on Land Day, which commemorates the historic and ongoing expropriation and dispossession of Palestinians from their land. We commit ourselves to take action against ongoing processes of colonialism and to support the rights and struggles of Indigenous peoples from Turtle Island to Palestine. Our event this evening will be split into two different parts. During the first part of this webinar, we'll hear about the history of the Canadian Museum of Human Rights, the absence of Palestinian perspectives from the museum, and what Palestinian Canadians have been doing to address this situation to make the museum more inclusive. We'll hear from a community activist, Rana Abdullah, who has been trying to engage with the museum for a decade, and also from journalist Candice Bodnarek, who has been following these developments very closely and recently wrote a piece about this. The second portion of the event will be dedicated to a Q&A session. I just want to say a quick word about CJPME before I invite Tom to begin. CJPME is an organization whose mission is to empower Canadians of all backgrounds to promote justice, development, and peace in the Middle East and here in Canada. So finally, I would like to invite Thomas Woodley, who will lead off the discussion. He is the president of CJPME, and he actually co-founded CJPME in 2004, becoming president in 2008. He's been working on issues related to Palestinian human rights for about 20 years. He has an academic background in public affairs with a specialty in policy analysis. And over the years, Tom and CJPME have been involved in supporting Rana Abdulu's campaign to get the Canadian Human Rights Museum to recognize the Nakba. So without further ado, welcome Tom, if you want to take it away from here.
Thank you very much, Michael. And welcome to everyone who's joining us here this evening. There was quite a good response, and it's just really exciting to see people from across Canada taking an interest in this. And this truly is an issue that touches all of us, because this is a federally funded museum that we're all basically paying for. So this is our chance to talk about it and get our heads around how we can make the museum more representative of truly the human rights spectrum, and specifically of the Palestinian issues. So I have the pleasure of introducing two guests here tonight. Our first guest this evening is Rana Abdullah. She's been at the forefront of the decade-long campaign to get the CMHR, we're going to say CMHR, Canadian Museum for Human Rights. She's been at the forefront of the campaign to get them to tell the stories of the Nakba. She's a Winnipeg-based Palestinian Canadian activist. She's also a recipient of the Manitoba Human Rights Award. During the day, she's a chartered professional accountant, and she's also co-owner of Winnipeg's Yaffa Cafe. So, ladies and gentlemen, welcome Rana. For me. We also have Candice Bodnaruk. I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly, Candice. We didn't actually check ahead of time. So Candice, as Michael said, she's a longtime journalist and peace activist in the Winnipeg area who's written about the Canadian Museum for Human Rights failure to cover the Nakba. She wrote an excellent article in the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs, and we highly recommend that people take a look at that. Candice has been involved in Palestinian human rights work for the past 14 years in Winnipeg. She's been involved with the Peace Alliance Winnipeg, as well as the Canada BDS Coalition. So we have a few sets of questions here, and we sort of felt for the sake of our audience, we'd start off with an initial focus on Candice, whereby Candice could tell us a little bit about sort of the origins of the museum and so on. So Candice, why don't you tell us a little bit, you know, where did the idea for the museum come from, and how did it actually get support from the Canadian government?
Sure, thank you, Tom. Well, Izzy Asper basically had the idea for the museum. So well-known Winnipeg businessman came up with the idea in right around the year 2000. He presented the idea to the federal government. Previously, starting in 97, he had launched a Holocaust education program in the schools. And he also ran a trip to Washington, D.C. to the Holocaust Museum there for school children. And I guess during that time, he realized there should be something like this here in Canada, potentially in Winnipeg, a Holocaust-focused museum where people could take school kids, their children, for education on this, as well as other Canadian human rights issues, because he found that there wasn't anything like that locally. And so once he pitched it to Kretchen at the time, he was favorable to the idea, and originally it said he would commit to $30 million in funding, and that later changed to $100 million. And they also have many private donors. That's through the separate group called Friends of the CMHR. So they have a lot of private donors, local businesses, corporations that donated, as well as the school boards, for example. They made donations so that they could actually have a classroom, for example, in the CMHR that's named after them.
Okay. And that $30 million you mentioned, is that sort of an annual budget, or was that just to build the museum, which turned into, I guess, $100 million?
Well, their actual annual budget right now, they had financial problems over the years because the museum actually wasn't making any money for a while, and people weren't coming into the museum like they thought they would be. like they didn't get a lot of visitors. So it was in 2016, actually, that the federal government at that time agreed to pay the taxes that the CMHR owed, which was $8 million. And then they did a new federal funding agreement that basically says the CMHR will get $2.7 million in federal funding per year.
Wow.
But the initial piece of funding, though, came from the federal government, as well as the province of Manitoba and the city of Winnipeg. So all three levels of government put in money. And then there was their private fundraising, as well as the monies that the private monies that the Asper family put in on their own to the museum. But right now, yes, there's a lot of federal money annually going into that museum. And that, of course, is one of the main reasons why, you know, all these human rights issues should be included. The Palestinian story must be there. It must be reflective of all Canadians.
Right. So basically, the way you've described it is that it sort of started off as the original idea was that it would be Canada's Holocaust Museum. And then that sort of evolved and morphed into becoming a Canadian Human Rights Museum. So what, and did that transition take place? When did the transition from the thinking to be at the Holocaust Museum becoming a Human Rights Museum? When did that sort of take place, that change in thinking?
From what I understand, Izzy Asper was quite influenced by the Museum of Tolerance in Los Angeles. So that museum, actually, I was looking at their website today, again, is very similar to the CMHR. They do have other human rights stories in the museum. I think Cambodia is one of them, and also Guatemala. But the main focus is the Holocaust. So similar a little bit to the CMHR. The Holocaust is a very large gallery in the museum, and the other largest gallery, and rightly so, is the Indigenous Perspective Gallery. You know, to Canada's Indigenous peoples, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, you've been to the museum a number of times, and just in preparation for this webinar here tonight, Candace went to the CMHR Saturday?
Yeah.
Just to check it out. Do you want to describe, just take half a minute to just sort of describe a little bit the museum, and you talked about the Indigenous. There is also a prominent Holocaust display, which is, of course, appropriate. Do you want to just take a second to sort of talk a little bit about what someone sees when they go into the museum and that sort of thing?
Sure. So, I mean, there is a main level there that has a display on the wall of human rights through time. And I was looking specifically to see if the Nakba was mentioned, because I had heard that the Nakba was actually on that timeline. And when I did look at that wall, what I did see was the Nakba is referenced as basically the 1948 Arab-Israeli War, and that's actually what appears there, but no other reference to the Nakba.
Right. I guess what you're referring to is that the CEO of the museum told you when you were interviewing her, she said there was a reference, though not by name,
right,
to the Nakba in the timeline in the main gallery, and you went on Saturday to check that out, and all there was 1948 Arab-Israeli War, and that is what we assume she was referring to, I guess.
Yeah, and other references would include, like, they do have a short piece on an organization in Ottawa that is dedicated to, I guess, Arab-Israeli and sort of Christian understanding. So there's that. And then there's a short video clip that they show about basically trusting news agencies. And it's about the 2012 Israeli attack on Gaza. And they show one clip from, I believe it's Jerusalem Post, and another clip from the MAN news agency. But they don't really explain, you know, the context of any of this. They say, well, these are two different perspectives, and it's up to the viewer to know how to analyze that and make a decision. But they don't explain the context. They don't explain that the Palestinians are occupied, or what's even happening in Gaza, and what Israel does when they regularly invade Gaza. So there's no reference point for a person to even understand that.
Yeah. Interesting. One final question before we move to sort of our second set of questions and take the focus over to Rena for a bit. One of the people that sent an email to the museum, as part of our campaign, they forward an email that they receive. So our campaign, for those we'll talk about a little bit more later, our campaign sends an email to the board trustees. It sends an email to the Canadian Minister of Heritage, and it also sends an email to your local member of parliament. Because it's a federally funded museum, the federal government is involved. Now, one of the MPs responded to one of the people that participated in the campaign, and the MP said, look, you know, the federal government, if you know, we don't get involved in the content of the museum. If you want to sort of talk, reach out to the museum and talk about content, here's a contact address there where you can go take your question to the museum. Now, to your understanding, what is the relationship? What sort of influence, or do you know whether or not the federal government has much influence over the content and management of the museum?
Well, I think initially Stephen Harper tried to get more involved. You know, when he was prime minister, there were certain things that he didn't like that the museum were doing at the time. Cretchen, you know, when he initially committed to that money, he supported the idea of the museum, but he actually thought at the time that it should be more of a private institution to avoid what he called, you know, government interference in the museum. Myself, I think that from what we've seen this past summer, 2020, with all of the controversy surrounding the museum, the things that have happened there with the racism, the sexual harassment, the shielding, covering up of LGBTQ exhibits, you know, this museum is under the umbrella of the federal government. It was made into a crown corporation, and the Museum Act was changed so that this museum could be located in Winnipeg. All these things were done, and there has been direct, you know, government involvement through funding over the years. And they also do appoint that board of trustees. So really, they do have some kind of responsibility, and they should be responding to it. Because, you know, it's the first federally funded federal museum outside of Ottawa. There's five national museums. It's the only one to be located here in Winnipeg. And this is supposed to be such a crown jewel, yeah, you know, for Canada and for Winnipeg. And they should be addressing that. And if they want this museum to succeed, they have to address, you know, the issues surrounding it. And I think we'll talk about this a little bit later, but I think, you know, with the appointment of the new CEO, they've also just yesterday announced their new diversity and inclusion person. I think that those are hopefully going to be moves forward at making changes in the museum that are going to be positive going forward for everyone.
Yeah, yeah. Well, as you say, we do have a section of the program a little bit later where we talk about some of the recent scandals and what might grow out of that. But it's interesting to hear your perspective, because so basically you would say to that member of parliament who said, you know, it's out of our hands, you would say, no, it actually, you have actually a role to play. And in fact, probably you need to play a bigger role than you've been playing, because sort of the museum is sort of has gone off the rails a little bit, and it needs some better management, or some more management oversight, basically, would be your message, it sounds like.
Correct, because they have, of course, they've chosen to remain at a distance and be hands off and let the museum govern itself. But clearly, for what we've seen, even for the past couple of years, these things were going on at the museum, that was too much of a hands-off approach, because no one was really overseeing their human resources, taking charge of what was actually happening there with, yeah, of all the staff. And so, yeah, there definitely has to be more oversight, whether it's done, you know, by the new museum executives, but also by the federal government.
Well, let's turn things a little bit over to Rena here. Rena, so glad you can join us here tonight, and thanks for your hard work on this. As I mentioned earlier, she's been working on this for 10 years. For many of us, this is the first hour that we spent thinking about this, but Rena has been thinking about this for more than the past 10 years. Rena, Candace and I talked a little bit about how Palestinians are represented in the museum. Is there anything that you would like to add, or anything that, you know, how in your opinion, is, you know, what currently does the museum have on Palestinians?
Well, the museum has selected a very limited number of human rights cases to feature Palestine. These cases do not represent the ongoing Palestinian experience of living under occupation. These cases have nothing to do with the colonization experience of Palestine. They're cases of human rights abuses that happened long time ago, not relevant. Cases that ignore the essential human rights case that's so relevant to the modern world, There's nothing to show how Palestinian people continue to be the victims of human rights abuses, the breach of the fundamental norms of the international law, human rights law, the UN Charter itself. They show, like Candace said, a very well put together video about contrasting media perspectives regarding the numerous assault on Gaza, very carefully balanced to send a message that there are two sides to the story. Well, yeah, of course, there's two sides to the story, but such attempts at being neutral and objective for people to form their own views fail because they avoid the hard truth. One needs to ask whether this attempt at managing the narrative is truly educational and to promote critical thinking, or whether it serves to flatten the narrative into something bland. Something else, as a subtext that comes to me as a Palestinian living all my life into this, that Palestinians are not allowed to tell their own story. Telling our truth the way we see it and we live it and how we should say it. And if we did, we should have follow rules. We have to have a minder of appearance as if we're on stage or in the media, and we have to be balanced. When our opposing point of view, such balance is not required. So when the museum created this, it's like a superficial acknowledgement of past history and not a serious presentation of the study of Palestinian human rights issue. And right now, I go to the museum often and I know exactly what's in there. And what's missing is that the persistent human rights violations against the Palestinians that led the process of the world's largest and longest unresolved refugee crisis.
Yeah.
What is missing is the essential Palestinian human rights case of ethnic cleansing. There's also no mention of the right of return.
Yeah. Rena, if I could just interrupt. You currently we've the webinar here, we talked about getting the Nakba into the museum. Have you been talking to the museum about the Nakba specifically? My understanding was that you had actually been bringing together stories. You had talked to friends and family and so on. You had actually brought together stories that you had actually assembled stories that you were ready to pass to the museum. Is that right?
I have taken Nakba survivors to them, and I have done this many, many times. I must say that I was involved in those discussions with the museum. I was not there on my own. I was guided by close consultation of many Palestinian organizations, human rights lawyers, and academics. Position has been and always remained that the Palestinian wants to see the Nakba join other similar historic events at the CMHR. I reached out to Nakba survivors in Winnipeg, and each time I had hope and I got excited that we're talking and making progress, more people joined me and more people activists. So to me, the Canadian Museum for Human Rights was a natural home for the Nakba narrative.
Right.
The Palestinian case somehow failed to qualify as worthy for its inclusion.
Well, and that's you know, one of the things that strikes me about that is that on the one hand, you have asked for that the Nakba be discussed. You've offered stories, you've taken the work and sort of collected, done sort of a original research and so on, and offered to pass that to the museum. Now, I was looking through some of the material that you sent to me in terms of the past exchanges. And I know one of the things that they have in the museum that's supposedly supposed to address this issue is a small exhibit under about a human rights defender section, which talks about Dr. Abul Al-Aish. And I understand that that was proposed to you at one point, and you had recommended that they not highlight him for a number of reasons. You want to talk about why you don't feel that he is necessarily, that he is a replacement for talking about the Nakba?
It's not Dr. Abul Aish himself. It's just the true history, the voice of the people.
Right.
74 years have passed, and this displacement has resulted in a large diaspora, stateless population, and they continue to live with the consequences of this to this day, including my parents and grandparents, continue to be blocked from the museum, and that's supposed to make us or help us remember and learn. Probably I can offer a very quick recap of this. Probably some of the audience, we're talking Nakba, they don't know the significance of this. The descendants of those expelled from their homes in 1948 are now over 7 million. Those original refugees left abrupt for their safety. There had been no time to plan. They left with nothing. The only thing they took was the key in their hand. to a house that they never again enter, a house that soon would be occupied by others who had unlawful right to it. So a reasonable question one would ask, why would nearly 250,000 people living peacefully in a land for generations suddenly decide to pick up and leave? What were they thinking? Is such an exodus normal thing to do? Was it really a catastrophe caused by God, like by nature? It wasn't. It was human-created catastrophe that sprung on them. So our goal is to work with the CMHR, regardless what they put of human rights defenders or whatever. Those are like small projects that they can do. They have to create a significant edition commemorating the Nakba in its permanent genocide exhibition. This, we understand, this is a long-term process done over the years with a number of intermediate exhibits and other talks or seminars until we get there. And again, it's a permanent exhibition covering the period and the impact of 1948 Palestinian Nakba as part of their genocide exhibition.
That's excellent. Exactly. So, and I think that's an excellent summary. And I think that's why this webinar and the campaign as a whole is focused on the Nakba, because it obviously has had such an impact. And one of the things, the reason I mentioned Dr. Abu Laish earlier, because I don't think necessarily people realize that the video that both of you guys referred to actually was highlighting this Dr. Abu Laish, who's a gentleman who lives currently in Toronto and who lost, I guess, was it two daughters and a niece during the 2014 Israeli assault on Gaza. And one of the things that strikes me is, how do we take some sort of present day or sort of modern day event and somehow say, well, that somehow replaces this terrible historic tragedy. So for me, it was just unthinkable that someone say, well, it's great, we've covered the Nakba. There's this story about Dr. Abu Laish in the Human Rights Defender Gallery.
I just wanted to say that the Canadians deserve the opportunity to form a balanced view. They have to have a fundamental understanding of the Human Rights Charter and its philosophy. And our story is an opportunity to build such understanding. This means not a bland video that glosses over those facts.
Exactly. That the Nakba will actually set the stage for anything else that may be understood following that. So let's talk a little bit about some of the things that Candace mentioned, alluded to some things early in our discussion here tonight about some of the things that happened over the summer. Candace, do you want to touch on some of the different things that happened? And, you know, you can take a little bit more time than you did earlier in terms of what were some of the things that happened and how did the museum and the public respond?
Sure, no, thank you for the question. And actually, just to back up for a moment as well, just in regards to Dr. Abu Laish, in terms of that exhibit, it has the fact that of course, his children and niece were killed, and his identity card is there, one of the children's toys. It does actually say that they were killed by an Israeli tank. And even though it's just a small piece, like Rana said, and it's out of context too, it doesn't explain, you know, the occupation, the Nakba, anything like that, the situation, how the Palestinians have to live day to day. That exhibit was deemed anti-Semitic when it was brought in, and they did get complaints from the Zionist community, which is interesting. And they've kept it there, but it's not enough. You know, it tells that one little piece of what happened. Not that it doesn't talk about how Gaza does not have a military, you know, that Israel regularly assaults them and aims at children, you know, aims at civilians to kill. So that's what happened there, but they've kept that exhibit up, which is interesting. But when I was there on Saturday, it's very tiny, small little bit in the occult, basically.
Yeah. Well, and what struck me about that too, and part of the reason I brought it up to you, Rena, was because they had actually asked you if what you thought about highlighting him in the museum. And the response that they got back from you and the people you were working with was, no, we don't think this would be representative of the Palestinian community. And yet they went ahead and did it. That's what I thought. But anyway, let's move on to modern day. And so Candace, do you wanna cover briefly some of the scandals? I guess it was mostly last summer sort of that these things broke, right?
Well, I can either talk about just the ones from last summer, or I can go back and talk about the scandals, the issues from the very beginning, because there were many of them, many groups. I mean, obviously Palestinians, but many groups felt excluded and protested the museum and lobbied to be included. but I can mainly talk about what happened last summer.
Well, I mean, if you want, why don't you go back to the beginning, but we just got to watch our time here a little bit.
Sure, I'll go quickly. So basically, so it started in one of the big ones was, you know, the Ukrainian community really wanting to get a permanent exhibit of the Holodomor in the museum. Initially, when it was announced, the museum was primarily just going to focus on the Holocaust and Aboriginal people's mistreatment by Canada. And those were going to be the two main galleries. And at the time as well, the Ukrainian community had given quite a large sum of money, like made donations to the museum. And they were actually told that they were going to be featured distinctly in the museum. So that had a big impact. They actually ran a postcard campaign asking people again to write at the time to the Heritage Minister, James Moore, to include the Holodomor, just like people are doing now, writing to the Heritage Minister, asking him to make sure Palestine is included. So this happened with the Ukrainian community. And basically it was in 2011, they did clarify that the Holodomor would have a permanent place in what was called then the mass atrocity zone, which is now called Breaking the Silence Gallery. I don't think it was ever called the mass atrocity zone, but at that time it was. And another piece I think that's really important is just the site itself. Rana and I talked about this a little bit earlier. CMHR was actually built on an Indigenous settlement. And this was known, like it came to be realized and people got involved, including a number of archaeologists obviously decided they would excavate the site. Now they thought this would take a number of years to do, but they were only given a certain amount of time to complete this excavation because the community, the Asper family, really wanted to get this museum up and running, the stakeholders. And they did find about 400,000 artifacts were actually found. And then the excavation stopped. So these were mainly shards of pottery. There some had food residue on it of Indigenous communities that had been there, living there on the site. But apparently Lee Sims, the Dr. Lee Sims, who I interviewed for my article, he said there could have been probably a million pieces recovered from the museum site if the excavation hadn't stopped. And he pointed out that the elders themselves hadn't been adequately made aware of the richness of the findings at the site, and the museum should have been making a commitment to present First Nations historic past and present heritage and take that seriously. And he said, you know, we've lost a rich First Nations heritage that was located on that site just to put up that museum. So there's that piece. And so that really is something. And just connecting, you know, the loss of heritage that Palestinians have experienced in the Nakba, and then, you know, what's ongoing regularly for First Nations people, and this again being in Canada, this being another example of that.
Right, right. No, absolutely. Go ahead. Yeah.
Oh, I was just going to say, I can skip now to what's been happening currently if you want me to.
Yes, yes, please do.
Okay, so I will do that. So basically, what happened starting in 2019, actually, what's interesting is the CMHR and the federal government both began using the word genocide to describe Canada's historical abuse of Indigenous peoples. So I think the federal government announced that first, and then the museum came after, because that was another controversy, is that they were not calling what happened to Indigenous peoples in Canada a genocide. And in the Breaking the Silence Gallery at the museum, Indigenous people still are not included there. So they've got the five main genocides that are recognized by the government of Canada, but does not include, of course, Palestinians, and does not include Indigenous people at this point. So last year, 2020, what happened was the CMHR decided to connect itself up with the Black Lives Matter movement. This was right after George Floyd was killed in Minneapolis, and they put out a number of tweets in support of Black Lives Matter. And at that point, a number of Black Indigenous staff came forward, as well as gay and lesbian staff at the museum, and said that the museum was lying, that it was filled with racism and abuse, sexual harassment, homophobia, and that, you know, the museum had to take some action around this. So there was a campaign launched called the CMHR Stop Lying. And at that point, the funders and major stakeholders that had associated themselves with the museum for a long time, they disconnected themselves, most notably Winnipeg's former mayor, Glenn Murray, our first openly gay mayor. He had actually had a fundraising role at the museum at the time. And he left after the story broke because what they were doing is they were censoring gay content. So they would actually either remove gay exhibits about gay rights, or they would have staff members stand in front of them. This was apparently at the request of teachers, specifically for school groups coming through, that they didn't want students to see these exhibits on gay rights in the museum.
Yeah, yeah. That's pretty scary, all of that, isn't it? That all those things would take place. It's just unthinkable. And the fact that, you know, a museum which is supposed to highlight human rights, is built on an indigenous site and has, takes no care to actually fully excavate the indigenous site for to better understand indigenous culture and indigenous context and history. I guess I missed a question that we wanted to ask Rena earlier, so my apologies. We did want to, so I'll jump back for a moment, and then we'll continue on a little bit with the present day. I know we've talked to Rena about your long struggle on this, and do you want to summarize the initiatives that Palestinian Canadians have taken over the past 10 years to actually engage with the museum?
Yeah, as I said, we wanted the Canadians to see a balanced view in the understanding of human rights, the Palestinian human rights, and there is the lived experience of the descendants of those original refugees who continue to live their shattered life, with severe vulnerability, having no protection, no country, nothing. That they can claim as their own, no right to settle, nowhere to flee. And this is what characterizes the problem of Palestine and how the Palestinian narrative should be shown at the museum and its exhibits. And we have proposed this and nothing beyond the Nakba, the ethnic cleansing and the genocide, but I was clearly dreaming. Nothing out of this sort was exhibited or even mentioned. The letters that we received from the museum officials were maybe, probably, perhaps, and could be, and might be, was never a firm commitment to any of the things that we discussed. And when I expressed my disappointment, they would tell me, oh no, you misunderstood. And I said, okay, I kept waiting, probably I had misunderstood. So on paper, the language was general tone. And by contrast, when I meet with them, there's very positive impression. And I would take home with me after our meetings. And I said, okay, maybe we're beginning to understand each other. So I get excited and invite more people. And when you ask me about other people in the community, I brought in Nakba survivors, people who lived the Lid massacre, who really witnessed that. Unfortunately, now they're not in good health so that they can witness, but I've taken a lot of notes and interviewed them. So it has been an experience with ups and downs. Again, I felt welcomed, and they showed interest and a lot of curiosity about the information I offered. When I took the Nakba survivors, I got excited to the extent of suggesting that, oh, we are doing more collaborative work. It was very frustrating. There was no planned framework, nothing committed. I felt there was some sort of bad faith on the side of the trustees, that there was no authentic interest in Palestine. It was like a desire to diffuse and calm down our community group, that we were only invited upon our we showed up on CBC. So we stopped because we thought we were just serving a political agenda, and that it can be claimed that Palestinians have been consulted, while in actuality their human rights story is being marginalized. But now we are looking at a very optimistic view with the new management. We're very optimistic. So I leave this whenever the question comes.
Sure. Well, why don't we go straight to that? So there is a new CEO at the museum, largely as a result of some of the scandals that took place last summer, I guess, right, Candace? So do you want to tell us a little bit about your thoughts, Rena, about the new CEO at the museum? And do you know anything about her? Are you optimistic that things will change moving forward?
Yes, I believe that with Aisha Khan, the new president, she's genuinely a positive person. I first met Aisha in 2009 through the Winnipeg chapter of the Canadian Council of Muslim Women. Aisha is a shining example of commitment and dedication for human rights and community service. She's trying to open doors to the Palestinian narrative to ensure that the museum is inclusive, and she's very genuine, she's very friendly. And I understand from our discussion that the Palestinian narrative is genuinely being considered for inclusion by the museum in both digital and physical form. But we don't know what it is yet, but probably using the vehicle of the International Court, ICC, that suggests the exploration of the Palestinian experience in the context of international framework and the concept of war crimes. And I thought, me and my colleagues thought that this was an excellent approach because this facilitates the presentation beyond war crimes, including the illegal settlements and discussion of right of return, the apartheid. And we're starting a long process. And I know for sure it will be challenged by other interest groups, but will remain at risk during development. But we could not have started a better way. I remain optimistic, and I understand the challenges, the political challenges that this project faced. But Ms. Khan assured us that their position is they want to do more work and to increase the presentation of Palestinian experiences. And I look forward for that to ensure that our narrative is finally accessible at their museum.
Yeah. So just to be clear, then, it was the museum itself in a communication recently to you that suggested maybe the ICC investigation of Israel might be a stepping off point to sort of talk about some of the broader issues. Was that what you just told us?
No, just like mentioning using the vehicle of International Court of Justice.
Okay, excellent. And Candace, what do you think? Do we have much to hope for with the new CEO and the new management and some of the changes that have taken place at the museum?
Well, I think that in itself is very positive. That actually was one of the recommendations from the report that came out of the scandals. So a human rights lawyer was hired to do the review of the museum. And the report that she wrote was called Rebuilding the Foundation. And so one of her actual suggestions was that the government of Canada put a new CEO in place who would be a person of color, most likely it should be female, as somebody from a minority group, more representative of the community, because since the museum began, the CEOs and the upper management have all been white and male. And with one of the former museum employees that I interviewed for my article, she pointed out as well that for a lot of the tours, for example, the tour guides were people of color, like they were diverse. So that was the face that was put out to the public. But the management was white and primarily male. Middle managers may have been, female, but basically that was the power structure there. So yeah, I think that it is important. And I think that Aisha has a real sense of, the Palestinian issues and wanting to include them in the museum, and that she's listening. So I think that in itself is really important and can only move it forward. I do think the only other issue I would have is with the Board of Trustees. They can ultimately, they can shut things down if they don't like the direction that it's going in. And what's interesting is they just created this diversity and inclusion committee that came out of one of the recommendations in the report. They created that. That's made up of people that were already, on the Board of Trustees.
Oh, really?
A few of those people have gone over to be in this diversity committee, and they are diverse. Like one of the women is Asian. I think there is a gay man that's part of that group and an Indigenous man. So that's positive. The only other piece of that is it's the same people, right, that are on that same Board of Trustees going over and being in this diversity committee that is saying that they're going to try to make change.
Right. Like how do you get change if basically you just keep the very same team?
Exactly.
So absolutely. That's quite. And that was just announced, what, just yesterday?
Just yesterday.
And has there been much of a public response? Like, was that covered in the local Winnipeg press? And what has been the response? Either of you, I guess, have either of you seen a response to that diversity and inclusion committee?
Well, it was announced initially on CBC Radio, and then I didn't see anything about it on the websites yesterday. I just found it again today that I found the news piece about it, but it wasn't mentioned yet on the CMHR website.
Okay. What are some of the next steps, Rena, that you would like? I mean, you've talked a little bit about some of the things, but are there any other things you'd like to discuss in terms of next steps that you'll be taking?
Yeah, we have a lot of hope. It is very exciting to have outreach from the museum now, much more promising than the reception we received a few years ago. We're looking forward to working with the museum staff to explore and map what's possible. We would like to see them arrive at a concrete plan with active participation, allowing how the NACBA experience can come to the museum floor within a few years as a meaningful contributing element to the museum's mission. We have management that shown themselves to be open-minded, showing willingness. They invited us, they spoke to us, they met with us, they scheduled meeting, and we embrace this opportunity and enthusiasm. It is sometimes difficult to overcome the lack of trust that we have developed with the previous management. And so the temptation is there and hold back like some of the enthusiasm, but we believe in their goodwill. We believe it's good time to move on from that experience and embrace this opportunity for a completely constructive working relationship. We right now stand a very positive place, and we believe that how the Palestinian history should be depicted and remains as it was. There's the history, there's the narrative, and we look forward for that participation.
Okay.
We provided them with information. We provided them with names of scholars, Canadian Palestinian scholars who can help them and who can provide input. Well, 6 Canadian Palestinian scholars and experts in Canadian universities who are willing to provide their expertise if they were asked to.
Fantastic. Professor Yasmin Abu-Laban at the University of Alberta, who's working with you and is bringing together those Palestinian academics. So that's really a good thing that you've you guys are all working together on that.
Yeah.
And I guess you guys, if I understood correctly as well, you actually have a meeting scheduled coming up with the museum staff.
Yeah,
fantastic.
In April. Also should mention that there's an enormous contribution by supportive communities on a consultation basis, because this is an initiative that should be Palestinian Canadian group leadership, so that they're helping us to achieve this goal. And it's very collegial work. And the Independent Jewish Voices nominated Dr. Abby Bakan. She's the professor of social justice education and science at the University of Toronto, to assist us in those efforts.
That's fantastic. Michael, why don't you choose one of the questions that we got, and we'll pass them to Candace and Rena as appropriate there.
Great. Yeah. So this was a great discussion, and we are coming close to the end of our time, but there are a few questions in the Q&A, and if you have a question, feel free to still submit it. We'll try to get to a couple of these, but I think one which is really important that I see here is for Rena, what would be a win for you? What would be a sort of a satisfactory outcome for you?
It's the CMHR presents the human history in a complete way. Right now, it is incomplete. They have the good intention. They have the right intention. They have the right mission. And this should be for everyone. But it is still not complete. And the Nakba is the most glaring aspect of its complete incompleteness. The CMHR has a very powerful role to play in how Canadians see themselves and the world from a human rights perspective. And the museum officials, if they're open to Palestinian stories, highlighting their sorrow and their victories, which provides the opportunity to enrich the content and the experience of the people visiting the museum. It's a very valuable institution to me. It should be fully funded and supported. Yeah, it's maybe based in Winnipeg, which is very small, but it's a Canadian federal museum. And it's very credible, but it's incomplete.
One question that came in is, how can other organizations, including Canadian Arab organizations, support the work that you're doing to try to convince the museum?
It is to write, to advocate, and to make our support difficult to ignore and write to the CMHR a simple message that NACBA deserves recognition to be complete. It needs to add, the CMHR needs to add the NACBA experience to give equal representation. Highlight the awareness of colonialism and its a long-term impact on us. Don't let the Palestinian narrative be buried by this museum or any other museum. It is important that Palestinians and to be included, not merely just listing our refugee population. Be curious and ask questions about the history. Put yourself in the shoes of those victims of human rights abuses and seek knowledge through empathy. Question their agenda and picture what it is to leave your ancestral home in a rush and not knowing where to go. Picture growing up in a refugee camp. The best power is in making, again, the global Palestinian rights advocacy to become impossible to ignore. And do not allow others to continue to define the scope of the conflict. They have to know the truth, and the truth that you will hear from the real people, real lives, real histories of the resilient and determined and displaced indigenous people of Palestine, and not from twisted media propaganda. We're asking the CMHR to reveal the history. I get very emotional talking about this because I live this every single day with my parents. So this is, and also tell them representing the Nakba is not an act of anti-Semitism. It is a historical event. The two are not connected. Nothing justifies or excuses what happened in the Nakba. Carry on gathering and on getting and gathering our Palestinian narrative, and we'll never forget.
Thank you, Rena. And you're absolutely right. And people need to understand the, you know, how visceral it is for many Palestinian, for every Palestinian Canadian. My father-in-law is Palestinian Canadian. He was chased from his home in Jaffa in 1948 as an 18-year-old. And it's something that he lived with his entire life. Michael, I happen to notice that question was from our friend Shireen at the Canadian Arab Institute. So Shireen, thank you very much for joining us. Shireen, CJPME is working with others to sort of support Rena's work. And it's really exciting that Rena has involved some Canadian Palestinian academics. But certainly there is certainly the ability to partner with CJPME and some of the existing partners on this campaign. So Shireen, I invite you and other people that represent organizations or constituencies, if you'd like to get involved, please contact CJPME. We are simply trying to provide a campaign to sort of support Rena and her colleagues as they continue this work to make sure that the museum knows that there's a broad community behind Rena and her colleagues. So Shireen, if you and anyone else would like to get organizationally behind this work, there's room for everybody on this. Candace, do you want to comment at all on are there things other Arab Canadian groups can do or other groups that you think can be done? And then I think we'll pass it back to Michael so he can do some wrap up types of things.
Sure. Well, I was just going to say again, I mean, write to the museum executives, as you mentioned. People should write to the trustees, but as well write to the Minister of Heritage, like the link that you've set up for a letter. And, you know, talk about this in your community with people that you know. People here around the world, I mean, I've read things online from people that, you know, have traveled to Winnipeg, think that the CMHR is just great, and maybe they haven't seen, you know, what's missing there. So to draw attention to those things, I think is really important. And yeah, I was just going to mention one last thing is, you know, when I was at the museum this past Saturday and they have a temporary exhibit up about the Rohingya, and viewing that and seeing those images of the women, you know, walking with all their belongings and the children on their backs reminds me of, you know, the UNRWA photos from the Nakba, like those UN photos, those historical photographs of the expelled people just, you know, leaving on foot with the wagons and all of their belongings. And the Rohingya as well have to carry identity cards. They are being displaced as part of their daily lives. And this story again mirrors, you know, the Nakba. These are all connected, these displacements, these dispossessions. And this story has every right to be in that museum along with all of the other, you know, the major human rights violations that the museum has in there.
And I'll just point out before Michael wraps up, Candace mentioned that you should mail or contact the board of trustees. If you participate in our campaign, the campaign actually does send your message to the individual members of the Board of Trustees. So that is a way to get your message through to them. So please consider, and Michael has been kind enough to put that up on screen at both at the beginning and a moment ago, he put that up. And I guess we can put it also, I'll put it in the chat as Michael wraps up here.
Yeah, I have a comment.
Yep, go ahead.
Okay, so the museum has been controversial since its inception. Taxpayers have strong views on how their dollars should be spent. And constituent groups have views on what stories should be told and should be done. And we, as Palestinians, one of those groups. But when donors make funds available, they expect to set the agenda. This is not supposed to happen. And I know that the museum is working through some audit processes to assess them in planning and addressing the gaps in their content. And with the new management, I'm very optimistic things will get better. The museum should have been designed from the start to be inclusive and equitable, and this is very understanding. The museum was created at the beginning as an institution rooted to the concept of hierarchy of human suffering, and that some people's suffering is more important than the others. And this really undermines the most fundamental principle of education. Educational protocols require us to compare and contrast those case studies, and it's hard to compare anything to something that has been artificially mounted on a pedestal. So what is the value of human rights that advances a narrow agenda that excludes key elements that comprise human rights? And by the way, we were told in 2013 that Canada does not recognize that. It was still in my mind, and it's very, very sad.
Yeah. Thanks to everyone for attending this event, including everyone who submitted a question, even though we couldn't get it to everyone. I'd like to thank Rana and Candice for joining us and contributing your fascinating insight. And it was a very interesting and engaging discussion. So thank you for sharing your time and your expertise with us. For more information about these issues, we have put together a fact sheet summarizing some of the main details related to the museum and some of Rana's struggles, as well as others, to make the museum more inclusive. So that's on this CJPME. So thank you again to everyone, all of our audience members, for your participation and your questions. Stay safe and have a good night, everyone.
So that's it for us for today. You were listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
feet. C is for
cauliflower.
Confusion. Creation.
Pickle. K is for
kitten.
Cam.
C, wait. Fianrof. C. U, unbearable.
U is for underground.
Oh, yeah.
Umbrella.
T. Trite.
Tremendous.
Torment.
Tire.
C. K.
I can't think of a U one. T.
T.
F is for famous.
Fun. Fumble. M is for Montreal.
Le palier d'alerte de votre région ou d'une région à proximité est rouge. Afin de limiter la propagation de la COVID-19, les rassemblements d'amis ou de familles dans les résidences et cours privées sont interdits. Les déplacements entre régions sont à éviter et les déplacements vers les zones jaunes sont interdits. De plus, il est défendu de quitter son domicile entre 20h et 5h le matin. Visitez québec.ca/coronavirus pour connaître les mesures en place. Respectez toutes les règles, tout le temps, sans exception. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
See.